Pepper Adams on baritone sax. He also was a clarinetist with Charlie Mingus's Haitian Fight Song. It's one of my favorites. This is from Adams's 1964 album, Pepper Adams Plays Charles Mingus. Adams died in 1986 of lung cancer. He was 55 years old. This is Lead Stories. I'm Nutrice Lead. And we'll be talking today about the midterm elections. And we're looking at specific parts of this discussion, only because it's still up in the air. A lot of, as is the case with most elections, and especially with this one, we have a lot of people contesting the results. We have a lot of counting still to be done. So there's a lot going on there. And we can say that the elections are over. We can say that with certainty. But beyond that, we have to be careful to point out that there are still results to come in, and it's not yet over. But I want to let you know that our guest today is a very popular guest, a very loved guest on this program, and that's Dr. Gerald Horn, who has been with us many, many times, and who has an uncanny way of breaking things down, owing to his expertise as a historian, political scientist, author, and analyst. He holds the John Jay and Rebecca Moore's Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. And he has written more than, well, I think probably now, Gerald, is it something like 36 books by now?
That's in the ballpark.
Yeah. And in the process of writing yet another, all with a unique perspective, all with the idea of representing points of view, a point of view that we don't get all the time. We don't have history books that tell history from the point of view of the oppressed. Very, very rare indeed. But Gerald, thanks for being with us today.
Well, thank you for inviting me. And let me also say that Haitian Fight Song is one of my favorites. In fact, I have a book coming out in a few months called Jazz and Justice, Racism, the Political Economy of the Music. And one of the chapters is entitled Haitian Fight Song. Of course, it deals with the efforts of Charles Mingus and Max Roach to organize an independent record company and distribution arm in the 1950s and coming up against organized crime, not to mention the misdeeds of big capital.
Wow, I'm looking forward to that, very much so. Well, as I said in the opening, we're not going to get into who won, who lost, how many votes are still to be accounted for today, because that's a process that is ongoing. But what we want to concentrate on more so is the bigger picture. What did this A midterm election mean? What was its significance? How do we relate to this election? How does it relate to us? So suppose you could get us started from your point of view as a historian. What was the significance of the midterm election?
Well, I think it was a step back from the brink of neo-fascism, although we're not out of the woods yet. I find it striking that analysts like former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright has written the book Fascism, a Warning, how Michael Kinsley, the commentator who was also part of the 1%, warned after November 2016 that Donald J. Trump was basically a neo-fascist. Jason Stanley of Yale has written a book on fascism. So you have a number of these elite commentators warning about the dangers of fascism, given the nature of the Trump coalition and given the nature of the Republican Party as we speak. With this election yesterday, we had a step back from the brink, but we're not out of the woods yet, not least because if you look at the correlation of forces, the balance of forces, when the votes are ultimately tallied, it'll probably reveal that Mr. Trump and his Republican Party probably got a substantial majority of the Euro-American vote. And even though one of the major failures of our friends on the left is a misunderstanding of U.S. politics, they don't realize that just as in Israel, in order to do anything meaningful, you need not just a majority of the Israeli vote, you need a majority of the Jewish vote, given the fact that Israel has about a 15 to 20% Arab minority. Well, in the United States, you need a majority of the so-called white vote in order to move forward. And when you have a majority of the white vote against you, it's very difficult to get traction, particularly since the ascendant Democrats, or the newly ascendant Democrats, do not recognize this basic fundamental point and oftentimes give short shrift to the fact that they're heavily dependent upon a black vote that votes against the Republicans and conservatives 9-1. Now, what we're facing right now is a kind of neo-Jim Crow. I'm speaking to you from Atlanta, Georgia, where I'm doing some research. And needless to say, in Atlanta, Georgia, there's quite a hullabaloo about the gubernatorial race, which has not been definitively decided, although you know that Stacey Abrams, a black woman, was challenging Brian Kemp, the Secretary of State, who was in charge of the vote, in fact, and had been busily purging black voters from the rolls in the run-up to Tuesday's election, which has caused certain commentators to suggest that you have a kind of neo-Jim Crow unfolding in Georgia. And I would dare say that it's not unique or peculiar to Georgia, which is one of the reasons why I say we're not out of the woods yet. I noticed that in his press conference or in recent remarks, the 45th U.S. president said that if the Democrats investigate him in the House, which they are pledging to do, he would adopt a warlike posture. I'm not sure what that means, although given the fact that the Republicans control the Senate and will be busily packing the federal courts because federal judges are basically passed upon and installed by the Senate, it's unclear going forward what the root of the United States will be. In previous circumstances, historically, when you've had a president under siege, like Mr. Trump will certainly be, they oftentimes try to distract the public and throw dust in the eyes of their pursuers by pursuing foreign adventures abroad, since the executive under this constitutional architecture has so much sway in terms of U.S. foreign policy. This does not bode well with regard to relations with Iran, which Mr. Trump has just tightened sanctions on. It does not bode well with regard to U.S. relations with China. Note that the United States is in the midst of a trade war with China. There's also a kind of rhetorical shooting war between Mr. Trump and President Xi Jinping of China. Relations with Russia, despite what we've heard in the press, are not ideal between Washington and Moscow. And so this does not bode well for international peace and security. And one final point I found it interesting in terms of this political campaign that the Republicans did not campaign on their so-called tax cut of December 2017, while Democrats, despite raising quite a furor about this alleged Russiagate scandal, quote-unquote, did not make that a major issue, even though they were beating the drums relentlessly with regard to this issue before the campaign started. And both of those are very curious episodes.
Well, we remarked on this and discussed on the program just yesterday the complete absence, it seems, of third parties or other independent parties participating in this election and thus not really offering an alternative to the old Republican-Democratic face-off dynamic that we've been accustomed to. What accounts for that, in your view?
Well, I think if you parse the remarks I just made, that you'll get an understanding. That is to say that it really starts with the beginning of this so-called republic. It was a slaveholders' revolt that involved a cross-class coalition between those between and amongst those of European descent, the much remarked upon Constitution and Bill of Rights did not apply to the African population, did not apply to the indigenous population. In fact, if you look at the Second Amendment with regard to arming militias, it was precisely aimed at the African population and the indigenous population. It took tremendous international pressure in the face of the Haitian Revolution and pressure from British abolitionists to force the United States to move away from slavery. And then after that, a vicious style of apartheid known as Jim Crow was installed, and it took international pressure there. That is to say, the rise of socialism, national liberation movements in the 20th century, to get the United States to move away from that. But now the international pressure has lessened, and understandably, perhaps, the Euro-American majority has reverted and regressed to its conservative, perhaps even neo-fascist origins of 1776. And in that kind of political climate, it makes it very difficult for parties of the left to thrive and survive. In fact, what you oftentimes see, as you've seen in recent elections, when parties of the left try to challenge the duopoly, the two-party hegemony of the Democrats and Republicans, it's people on the left who will reprimand and rebuke these parties on the left. Now, they don't reprimand and rebuke them along the lines that I've just said. They don't say that, look, you know, a lot of these Euro-Americans are backwards. So if you take a third-party route, you won't get too much traction. No, they don't say that. In fact, if you look at, say, the recent film by Michael Moore, Fahrenheit 11/9, and he focuses a lot on West Virginia, you get the idea that West Virginia is on the verge of a socialist revolution, people marching in the streets, et cetera. You never know that Donald J. Trump won West Virginia by double digits. Now, what I'm saying is that there is almost like an intentional misreading of the political structure and politics, particularly of the Euro-American majority. People find it difficult to acknowledge that this majority is soaking in the brine of white supremacy and racism, I'm afraid to say. And if we don't wake up to this reality sooner rather than later, we'll have a lot of time to debate this history and this reality in the concentration camps in Yankee Stadium.
Wow. 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 That is quite an answer. I want to talk about Barack Obama here at this juncture. With all the craziness that led up to the election and, of course, that crystallized at the election, it still remains, I think, noteworthy that although we supposedly knew this president, okay, we've been talking about his brash ways, his racism, his homophobia, his anti-immigrant sentiments, and how these things have inspired not only the electorate, that the portion of the electorate that is in his camp, but also Trump actually took control of this election and provided the I don't want to use the word intellectual because that elevates him, but provided the compass, if you will, for how his troops in Congress, in the Senate, in the House, ought to behave in terms of an election, what the main message points were supposed to be, how they were to utilize strategically the message points to rally their political base, and then, of course, to bring it all home. On the other hand, we had Barack Obama, the former president, who was very popular, popular to the tune of two consecutive terms. And he decided to enter the fray to encourage a heavy turnout for the Democrats. Would it be off base to suggest that in the end, as we look at the performance during the midterm elections, we could say that Donald Trump, with all of his hatred and all of his racism and invective, basically won in terms of how you do politics in this country? What is important, especially when you are the messenger of white supremacy? Should Barack Obama have done more? Should he have been more involved? Should the Democrats have had a clear message? Should they have understood how formidable an opponent Donald Trump, because this was really a referendum on Trump and Trumpism, did they underestimate the pervasiveness of his political theory and his thoughts and his attitudes and how it would inform the political decisions of his base? Was there a major miscalculation here by Democrats and in particular by Barack Obama?
Well, that's possible, but I would not limit the suspects to just Democrats or Barack Obama. I mentioned Michael Moore. I could mention other forces on the left and other individuals and personalities on the left who routinely miscalculate and misestimate the what they see as a kind of progressivism in the Euro-American body politic that's just not there. And one wonders, their usual idea is that if the Democrats would just move more to the left, then the Euro-American working class and middle class would stop voting for the right, which is obviously a non sequitur, number one. And then number two, they never pause to ask, well, the black working class does not move to the right and vote for the Republicans. They vote 9-1 against the Republicans. And you would think that that would cause them to reflect more deeply on their basic and fundamental analysis, but somehow they do not. Now, it's apparent that Mr. Trump ran a campaign on the platform of fear, particularly appealing to the most primitive and retrograde sentiments in the Euro-American majority, that they should fear an alleged invasion from the South of brown people, not to mention black and brown people at home, not to mention an alleged treachery of so-called non-white people abroad, speaking of China. And so it was a rank and retrograde racist campaign that Mr. Trump ran. And to the extent that you're suggesting that he may have a better understanding of the electorate than some of his Democratic Party and even left-wing opponents, well, I think you have a point. I think that, as I've suggested in the last few minutes, what has pushed the United States away from slavery and Jim Crow and reactionary politics generally were global forces, as already enunciated. Now that those global forces are not putting as much pressure on U.S. imperialism, at least not in the same way as they once did, the beast has been reawakened. And despite the fact that the Democrats now apparently control the House, that beast is not going to sleep anytime soon. I should also say that, ironically and perhaps perversely, the United States right now reminds me of Afghanistan. What I mean is that U.S. imperialism did such a deft job over the last few decades in routing a left-wing government in Kabul that had been in power from the late 1970s up until the rise of the Taliban in the 1990s, of course, the latter being backed by U.S. imperialism and then allegedly opening the door to Osama bin Laden, who supposedly launches this attack on New York and Washington in 2001. But now, Afghanistan, the job that was done on the left was so expert and so deft that it's very difficult to be optimistic about the future course of Afghanistan in terms of progressive politics, in terms of policies for women in particular. And likewise, with regard to U.S. imperialism, such a deft and expert job was done in recent decades in destabilizing the left, routing left-wing labor. I oftentimes cite the cases of Harry Bridges, the leader of West Coast Longshore, who the United States spent a small fortune trying to deport back to his native Australia, not least because his union was so good at integrating black people into the ranks, at bringing higher paychecks and better working conditions, and not least helping to install a program of labor education and political education, which obviously is sorely and conspicuously lacking with regard to the working class as a whole. And that is not an accident. It happened as a result of conscious policies pursued by the U.S. elite to the point now where, looking forward from this election on Tuesday, it's not easy to be optimistic about the future course of progressive politics in the United States of America, despite, as noted, the Democrats taking over the House, because Mr. Trump still has a retrograde base rooted in the Euro-American majority who are going to blame the reality that surely will unfold that he will not be able to deliver to this base, but it'll be blamed upon obstructionism amongst the black and brown people, amongst their supposed Democratic Party protectors, which then will help to engineer a further push towards the right on a course of devolution that apparently has no bottom. Now, what could change that scenario, it seems to me, is some sort of external force. These conflicts over Iran, which is going to draw into the fray Russia and China, perhaps even the European Union, that could disrupt that scenario that I've just sketched.
What happened on Tuesday? We still have to plumb further as things develop. We'll be adding more information to how we interpret the events of Tuesday. But is there now, in your view, a need for coming, for organizing vigorously, and we talked about this yesterday, with the complete absence of even a third party to give people options? To say, well, okay, I don't like the Democratic Party. I don't think they have a message. I don't think they're doing the right thing at the moment by their predominantly black base. What could an alternative be? Would it involve a convention of some sort among people who are trying to figure out what the best strategy would be for recouping? Or do we just let the third parties, like the Green Party and other parties, the Working Families Party, just give them a pass and say, we know that it's been tough, and maybe next time?
Well, no, I would not want to give up on the Working Families Party or the Green Party. I think that there are still progressive elements, in fact, who are working within the ranks of the Democratic Party. But you mentioned an idea of a convention. I think that that's a useful idea, particularly a bringing together a black convention, because if you look ideologically at the black community in the United States, you basically see three ideological trends. You see a sort of liberal trend, which is represented in NAACP to a degree in the Congressional Black Caucus. You see a black nationalist trend, which oftentimes does not take organizational form, but I think is quite significant on campuses, for example, and in a wider community, and particularly amongst the youth. And then you see a minority trend, which is taken the blows in recent decades, the sort of left-wing anti-imperialist trend, which exercises a certain amount of ideological influence, but is not strong organizationally. However, bringing those forces together would allow that latter trend to exercise more influence over these other two trends, which I think could lead to at least two initiatives that would be quite useful. One initiative would be to get our forces within the labor movement to push more aggressively for working class education, labor education, in the context, of course, of pushing for higher wages and working conditions. I mean, for example, just a few months ago in Houston, I spoke to the Black Caucus of the Teamsters. The Teamsters long has been one of the largest unions in the capitalist world. Many of these Black Teamsters work for UPS, which, as you know, is undergoing a bit of labor unrest as we speak. Now, that's just one example of how we can bring together forces from the anti-imperialist left with working class forces who can then push for a broader and wider agenda with regard to political education, labor education, et cetera. And then the other thrust would be towards internationalizing our struggle. Whenever I've spoken in the last few weeks, I've taken time to mention that President Erdogan of Turkey, when he came to the United Nations General Assembly in September, he came bearing gifts, so to speak. He had just engineered the renaming of the street on which the U.S. Embassy in Ankara is located after Malcolm X. And then while in New York, he met with the daughters of Malcolm X. Now, that kind of news at one time would have been leaped on by advanced forces in our community, seeing an opening, particularly given Turkey's rather tempestuous relations with Washington right now, in light of the fact that only recently the United States had sanctions on Turkey. But those kinds of international openings are not being capitalized upon by our community, which means that there's less pressure externally on U.S. imperialism, which means that it'll be more difficult to reverse this right-wing course on which U.S. imperialism is now embarked.
Speaking of which, Donald Trump seems to be dedicated to ramping up his strategies and agenda for the advancement of white nationalism, as he's calling it, in the United States. Which brings the question, what is likely to be the fallout in Congress and in state legislatures, particularly in major cities where you have large urban, quote-unquote, areas, and presumably with that you have an increased political representation by African-Americans and Latinos?
Well, it's unclear. I mean, look at Texas, where I happen to work and reside every now and then. Texas has a substantial black population, about 15%. As a matter of fact, Texas is now grouped with Hawaii, California, and New Mexico, and Nevada as being a so-called majority-minority state. That is to say, where people of color basically comprise the majority. Texas has representatives in the Congressional Black Caucus, Sheila Jackson Lee and Al Green amongst them. It just elected two Latinas to Congress, Veronica Escobar and Sylvia Garcia, the former from El Paso and the latter from Houston. And yet, Texas also is probably the most retrograde and reactionary state in the United States of America. When you're talking about right-wing politics and conservative and reactionary ascendancy, you're basically talking fundamentally about Texas, as represented by the fact that the rather repulsive incumbent Senator Ted Cruz was reelected, despite the fact that Beto O'Rourke, his Democratic Party challenger, outraised him financially by about $30 million, from $70 million to $40 million. And so therein, we see part of the problem with regard to our friends on the left, because understandably and perhaps even justifiably, they've been pointing to the Citizens United case by the U.S. Supreme Court as helping to tilt the scales in favor of the right wing in terms of unleashing a tidal wave of money to favor corporate interests. But here you had Beto O'Rourke actually outraised Ted Cruz and still lost by 3 points. So obviously, sometimes there is this focus on procedural issues, which is what I consider to be a campaign finance is a procedural issue, much more than the nuts and bolts and nitty-gritty of substantive issues, labor education, working class education, et cetera. Now, to his credit, Congressman O'Rourke, he sent legions and battalions going door to door. And sometimes it takes a while for plants to flower. What I'm suggesting is that hopefully that going door to door throughout the broad expanse of Texas will bear fruit in November 2020, perhaps. But that's the kind of effort that's going to be necessary if we are to reverse this dangerous and disastrous course on which we're now on.
So would you say then that the election gave us an example of the new blueprint for politics in the United States?
You mean in terms of Donald J. Trump's white nationalism?
Yes.
Well, sure, except it's not a new blueprint. I think it's a regression. It's a reversion. I think that this country was fundamentally founded as a white nationalist project. I mean, what's interesting is that many of our so-called friends on the left have handed very powerful rhetorical tools to the right wing, which then the right wing uses to bash us. I mean, look at the term identity politics, for example. In the wake of the November 2016 election, you had an Ivy League professor whose name will not pass my lips, who wrote a book suggesting that black identity politics helped to put Trump in election into office. Now, the black folks voted against Trump 9-1, so it's real bank shot reasoning to suggest that those who voted against the candidate 9-1 are actually responsible for putting him in office. What he was trying to say was that black lives matter, and black people, young black people protesting against being shot down by officers of the state, so outraged and incensed the Euro-American majority that they trooped to the polls and cast a ballot for Donald J. Trump. Now, anybody who knows beans about U.S. politics knows that since 1964, the Euro-American majority has been voting steadily from the right. That is to say, ever since the Civil Rights Act of 1964, there has been this low-intensity warfare against that legislation, not to mention low-intensity warfare that oftentimes increases in intensity when Election Day comes against the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And so, obviously, it's rather poor reasoning to overlook that scenario that I've just sketched, and to try to point the finger of accusation at black people being executed like dogs in the streets and the protests against same as the reason why white nationalism flourishes. It's short-sighted historically. And what's interesting is that you have now conservatives. I think of David Brooks of the New York Times and Max Boot, who just wrote this book about why he's defecting from the Republican Party ranks, who oftentimes use the term white identity politics. You rarely hear our friends on the left use that term, white identity politics, because that's what's at issue. That's what's ruled this country ever since 1776, and that's what's now flourishing in light of the fact that, in terms of culpability, the black community, with its liberal and black nationalist leadership, has not been able to develop a global strategy to counteract this white identity politics, unlike black people in the past. You know, as you know, I've been going back in history, doing these books. I did a book on the 17th century that was just published this year. Now I'm doing a book on the 16th century. And one of the things that, that strikes me the further I go back into history is how these enslaved Africans, when they first started arriving into North America in the 1500s, even though there are going to be these big celebrations about 1619 next year, actually you had enslaved Africans in Florida as early as the 1500s. But what's striking is how even then, even though many of them were not necessarily literate, they were trying to develop international strategies to combat their oppressors. And now you have these folks who are apparently literate. I mean, that's the inference I draw from the fact that their nose is always buried in their smartphones. And yet they're not able to, they have the smartphone, they have access to everything that's going on all over the world. But somehow they're not able to develop the kind of global strategy that would rescue us from this peril that we're now enduring.
Well, we'll take a break so that we can take a couple of your questions at 888-874-4888. Our guest is the extraordinary, and we're so happy to have him, Gerald Horn, a professor of history and politics, a political scientist. He's a prolific author. And as you can hear, he has an excellent grasp on the issues. 888-874-4888, and we'll take this break and come back to your questions directly. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. We're talking about the big picture issues relative to the midterm elections held on Tuesday. And this is fascinating to me because people kind of go literally, you know, who won, who lost, how many, who got how many votes and so forth. Yes, that's important. But we really need to understand the structure that we're talking about, the structure of elections. What are they supposed to do? And how they relate to our everyday lives. And we're hearing, for the first time, I think, anywhere, we're hearing an analysis that is not readily available. So I hope we appreciate that. But in the meantime, I just want to ask you, what are you working on right now, Gerald?
Well, I have a book, two books coming out in a few months. One, a big book on Southern Africa, U.S. imperialism and anti-communism in Southern Africa from Cecil Rhodes in the late 19th century up to Mandela in being elected in 1994. Then, I have a book coming out on the music we call jazz and justice, racism, the political economy of the music. That'll be out in a few months. What I'm working on now is a book on the 1500s, as I just suggested. It's a precursor to my book on the 17th century, The Apocalypse of Settler Colonialism, and a precursor to my book on the 18th century, The Counter-Revolution of 1776. And I'm working on a book on Washington, D.C., the black community in Washington, D.C. over the decades, because this is the nation's capital, and it is rather ironic that a white supremacist state would somehow have a black majority in its capital, a situation that's now rapidly being reversed in light of gentrification sweeping through Washington, D.C. And then I'm working on a book on boxing, which deals, of course, with masculinity, organized crime, et cetera.
Well, clearly, you're just not working hard enough. You have to pick up the pace a bit. Daryl from New York, you're on with Professor Gerald Horn.
You chased Lee, Gerald Horn, two people who I've worked with thousands of years ago, I just wanted to know, Joe, have you ever thought about, or do you have, let me ask it this way, do you have like an online syllabus of your works, and how could people get access to interviews such as this so that they could use them to do the organizing work that's required?
Well, the answer is yes and no. I mean, a lot of my stuff is all over the internet. It's on SoundCloud. It's on YouTube. You know, my books can be found at Barnes & Noble, Amazon, the University of Houston website, et cetera. So it's all over the place. Yeah, basically.
Okay, thank you. Henry from Chicago, you're on with Dr. Gerald Horn.
All right. Greetings to you, Therese, and greetings, Dr. Horn.
Thank you.
I was wondering, it seems like Donald Trump has been influenced by what happened in the Dominican Republic a couple of years ago in regards to the birthright citizenship. And I was wondering if there was a direct political relation, you know, with whoever is the political rule in the Dominican Republic and Donald Trump, because it seems like he's taking, you know, with the birthright citizenship that he's trying to repeal, he's taking that exact same playbook. So do you have any, you know, comment on that? Thanks.
Yeah, I do have a comment. In my 1776 book, I drew a parallel between the history of the Dominican Republic and the history of the United States. That is to say that many of our friends on the left, they oftentimes point to the Bill of Rights as being the saving grace for the United States of America. But, of course, as I just intimated in talking about the Second Amendment, the Bill of Rights did not apply to a goodly number of us, particularly those of African ancestry. And in any case, it was meant to cement a certain kind of whiteness and to be combat pay for those Europeans sufficiently audacious to wander to the war zone that was North America. And I also pointed out that Rafael Trujillo, the longtime dictator of the DR, when ships bearing Jewish refugees were being turned away from many ports, including those of North America, he was taking them in. And it wasn't because Trujillo was progressive. He was trying to whiten the population. And that's what I intimated about U.S. history, that there has been this conscious effort to try to whiten the population, so to speak, and that's oftentimes mischaracterized as being benevolent, say, towards the Jewish American population, which should have been questioned at least after the Pittsburgh massacre of about 10 days ago or 2 weeks ago. And I also should point out that in my book on the Haitian Revolution, there's a good deal of Dominican history. I point out that when the Dominican Republic comes into existence circa 1844, it's basically in a revolt against black-led Haiti. And I also try to point out that the races and slave-owning then U.S. Secretary of State John C. Calhoun, in one of the major victories, quote-unquote, of U.S. covert action, is supporting the rebels who secede from Haiti to set up the DR, which then sets up decades of conflict between the DR and Haiti, which continues to this very day, which the caller just made reference to concerning trying to denationalize or withdraw citizenship from darker-skinned people who are seen as being foreigners or Haitians, even though they were born on the soil of the DR. Now, of course, let me quickly say that I do not question the sovereignty of the Dominican Republic. I'm only trying to bring these episodes to the table so people can draw the appropriate conclusions, which brings us to this controversy concerning birthright citizenship and the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. Now, Mr. Trump says that the current interpretation, which says that those who are born in the United States are citizens of the United States, that he's going to try to change that through executive order, not through a constitutional amendment, not through a constitutional change. Now, keep in mind that the 14th Amendment was meant to reverse the Dred Scott decision of 1857, where the U.S. Supreme Court said that black people could not be citizens of the United States of America. The 14th Amendment said anybody who was born here could be a citizen. So if Mr. Trump tries to revise or repudiate the 14th Amendment, what does that say about black people who were born here in the United States of America? That is to say, the ostensible target of this alleged or purported executive order that Mr. Trump is going to issue are those of Latin American descent, those of Asian descent. But I dare say that the damage will not be limited to those groups, and that those who vote against the right wing 9-1, the aforementioned black community, will certainly be in the crosshairs if Mr. Trump's demented dreams come to fruition.
Thank you for your question, Henry. Jeff from New Jersey, you're on the air.
Hello, folks.
Dr. Gerald Hahn.
Hello.
Okay, quickly as you can get to your question.
All right, there's two questions. One, what about voter fraud? I don't think that we paid attention close enough to the counts of the vote. Therefore, when we do these analysis, how off can we be? There's a good video, the best democracy money can buy. And number two, on a global scale, we're starting to see these other conservatives and these other things like Trump come in, and how much, who is that machine behind this thing, like Ed Bannon or his PR firm, what they're doing as far as things in Venezuela and in the Scandinavia, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, first of all, with regard to the latter point, it's apparent that Mr. Bannon is quite busy. I'd like his frequent flyer points. He's been advising neo-fascist candidates such as Jair Bolsonaro, the neo-fascist just elected to be president of Brazil. He's been very busy in Eastern Europe with Viktor Orban, the neo-fascist who now rules Hungary. He's been very busy in Italy, where neo-fascists are part of the ruling clique that rules Italy as we speak. He's been very busy in Austria, where you have neo-fascists in power. So this is the kind of international climate that makes neo-fascism more likely in the United States of America. I mean, it's just like the 1930s. I mean, you not only had ultra-right wingers in power in Rome and Italy, they'd extended their strength deep into Eastern Europe, for example, and then, of course, sought to overthrow the Ethiopian regime, which they did successfully by 1935, 1936. With regard to your previous point, certainly voter fraud is part of the political landscape in the United States of America. Much has been made of the fact that here in Georgia, from where I'm now speaking, Secretary of State Brian Kemp was in charge of the vote and had been busy as a beaver purging voters from the rolls in the run-up to this election. You have antiquated, archaic voting machines, which are not that difficult to manipulate. These repeated charges that people vote are being flipped, that they'll vote for one party and the machine will register for another party, which brings me hopefully to some good news, which is that in the state of Florida, the voting rights of those who are deemed to be felons, quote unquote, apparently have been restored. I have not read the fine print, but that's the apparent implication of the vote yesterday. And likewise, in Louisiana, that state is moving towards having unanimous juries in order to be convicted for crimes, including felons. The fact that you did not have unanimous juries in order to be convicted for crimes in Louisiana helps to account for the fact where there are so many black men, in particular, in Angola prison in Louisiana. And of course, it's not accidental or even paradoxical that the leading prison in Louisiana is named after a country in Southwest Africa, given the fact that whether they know it or not, many of the inmates actually have roots in Southwest Africa.
Thank you for your question. We go next to CC from New Jersey. If you could make your question as concise as possible, so we can.
First, I want to say thank you, Eutrice, for having Dr. Horn on. This is a treat. for sure, especially after yesterday. I just have a couple of quick questions, real quick, and they'll be quick answers. Jeff's asked one of them. And should we be voting? Should we be organizing diligently and seriously for 2020? Or should we be sitting out? Dr. Horn.
No, I see voting as one more tool in the toolbox. Unlike some of our liberal friends, I don't see it as the only tool in the toolbox or even the ultimate tool in the toolbox, but it is a tool in the toolbox. It's not necessarily a sledgehammer. It's not necessarily even a Phillips screwdriver. But it is a useful tool, and the danger and peril we now face means we cannot ignore any tool. Certainly, I would salute you for stressing organizing.
Thank you, Cece, for your question. You can have one short one that requires a short answer, but then we have to go.
Okay. After the election that has happened yesterday, what's our next step? I know it's a participating versus a spectator. What should we do next as neophytes, as cadets, the next steps? What should we be doing?
Well, I think you and Utrice have hit upon 2 points. You mentioned the question of organizing, be it in student unions, be it in working unions, working class unions, be it in tenants unions, for example. I would also add to that list of study groups, something that seemingly has passed from the scene. I recall when I was much younger, those were a necessary part of the landscape. Utrice mentioned the idea of holding some sort of convention where you bring together these disparate political and ideological forces within our community to put our heads together to try to come up with a new domestic and international strategy. I think that both of those approaches lend themselves to individual activism and collective activism, because certainly we need both.
Well, I thank you, Cece, for your question. And I thank you, Gerald, for being available to us today. And, of course, as usual, sharing some rather deep insights into an issue and a topic that would not get this kind of attention or analysis. It is imperative that people begin to understand. Don't get all excited about, okay, there's an election. Just take your time. It's already happened and with a little bit more to go. But carefully analyze things. Think about things, because that is what is going to inform our future actions. Thanks, Gerald, and we will talk again soon, hopefully.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Thank you. That brings us to the end of our program today. I hope it was useful. And again, I hope it reinforced in you the idea that although everybody's huddled together and being shoved into one direction or the other, it's in a sense a massive distraction. What they don't want us to do is to sit down and think and look carefully at all the moving parts and come up with something that would work and would work for us. Thanks for joining me today and for listening and for participating. We'll talk to each other again tomorrow. Bye-bye.